the human being is a biological phenomenon himself. He's a product of nature. And he has this body, which is like the body of the grass or the trees, a product of this good earth. And on the other hand, in contrast to the trees and the grasses and the little bugs, he has this great brain up here, which has a structuring character that is not that of nature. It has its own almost mathematical kind of thinking. Rational thinking is, let's say, rectangular, whereas the body thinking is circular. These are the two kinds of consciousness that are right in us. One is that which the Indians call the Vijnanamaya Kosha, the sheath of wisdom, the wisdom that's digesting our meals, you know, and that brings the grass up, and that we share with the whole world of nature. But then there's this Manomaya Kosha, this intelligence of the brain, which has plans for how life should be. And it's not always the way life wants to be. So there's a conflict between these two worlds. I think of it really in the way of the city, particularly a city like New York. San Francisco is a little different because on these hills you can see the nature world, you know. But in New York you're in those canyons. And when you see the moon over New York City, you just are amazed. There's another nature world. So the mind may be very well at home in New York, but the body, the other support to the mind, which is the nature, our biology, is out of accord with that. And then you go out into even Westchester County, you know, just the suburb area, and you begin to feel, the body says, here's where I belong. These are my friends. Now, the tendency in our culture, you see, is to be more and more of this mathematical organization instead of the organic. And the interaction between these two is what keeps us civilized and harmonious human beings. Now, the two things to be said. One is, in wilderness is the salvation. Yes, if that's wiped out, we're nothing but mechanical. But the next thing is that the whole function of myth is to unite these two orders of our nature, the mental nature, the waking consciousness nature, and that thing that takes over in sleep. When people have nightmares, it's principally because they have been repressing the biology, you know, and it comes up with a vengeance. The deity that is disregarded turns into a devil, becomes negative. And nature then becomes feared. If it has been suppressed long enough and you're out of accord with it, because of course it always is going to break up the quadrangular mode of planning that you've had for your life. Break, falling in love, there's nature coming, and my God, it's a wreck of many a program.
Yeah.
And the nature world, the wilderness world, it's a wonderful thing to meet. But then we've got to have the other one too, you see. Yeah.
Do you have any insights just about how we as individuals can recover our contact with nature?
I think that's just a question of life planning, that you should put yourself in a situation so that you will have that refreshment from time to time. But if in your weekend or holiday you keep yourself in the world of enclosed, civilized living, then the nature is becoming starved inside you. That's just individual planning, I think.
Yeah. My next question is related to what we've been talking about and how we've gotten out of balance. And I think you have something to say about this. And that is the quest for right living, the quest for doing something that's harmonious with our life, looking at our society and, again, looking at the past and from a mythical standpoint, that now we're in a place where usually most of our work is separated from our life. There are all these dichotomies. There are these splits built in. And yet if we look at history, if we look at the past, we can see that those people who got along the best seem to be those people who had a unity in their life, that their work was part of their life, that it was unified, and now we have the splits. How do you see that?
Well, again, I can look at it only in terms of an individual. And I think the individual who takes a job in order to live for the money or something like that, he's turned himself into a slave. He's a money slave. And you might say work, it begins where you don't like what you're doing. I heard a little formula way, way back. Make your hobby your source of income. Then there's no such thing as work. And there's no such thing as getting tired. It's been my own experience. I did just what I wanted to do. It takes a little courage at first because who the hell wants you to be doing just what you want to do? They've all got a lot of plans for you. But you can make it happen. And then there's no such thing as work. People say, when do you take a holiday? Well, a holiday's often just a bore because I'm not doing what I really want to do. No, I think that it's a very important thing for a young person to have the courage to do what seems to him significant in his life and not just take a job in order to make money. But this takes a bit of prudence and very careful planning and so forth and may delay some of your achievements in the field of money and earning and comfortable living. But the ultimate result will be very much to your pleasure. But if you have a job, and it takes so much of your time, and at the same time, you do have enough time left to do the development of your own system of ideas for the future, whatever it's going to be. And then the boss says, well, if you work 2 hours more, I'll give you more money. Then you say, no. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's an early decision of courage to do the thing that it's your authentic drive. I think that's the path. Where there's no path, you know.
Dive into the deep water.
The gateless gate.
The unmapped.
Take the rap. But I found, I don't know how it is right now, because my days were a long way back, but in the 20s and 30s, there were plenty of marginal areas where you could incubate your destiny. I think they must still exist. I know a few of them.
In this program, Joseph says, more pointedly than we've heard him say before, that the sense of most myths is to find the dynamic source in your life, which is at the very root of Campbell's work. We'll also hear him elaborate on what he called the essential unities inherent in different myths and religious systems from around the world, a point he also made in a talk he gave at the New Dimensions Radio 10th anniversary celebration, which is included in this program, as well as later in the series. This conversation took place in the fall of 1980, when Joseph was 76. We began with a question about the timeliness of mythology. Hello, Joseph.
Michael, it's a real pleasure to be with you again.
Well, it's great to be with you, too. I think where I'd like to begin, Joseph, is that somehow we've related to mythology as just fairy tales and being largely untrue, and mythology is so much more than that.
Well, I think the reason for the misunderstanding is that the imagery and tales of mythology are symbolic of spiritual powers within us. And when these are interpreted as referring to historical and natural events, and then science shows that these historical and natural events did not or could not have occurred, then you throw the whole thing out. But mythology really is the language of discourse between our unconscious system, the spiritual life that really shaped our bodies, and the intellect, which is regarding the outer world all the time and thinking in terms of practical facts and so forth. And the intellect has to learn to read these symbolically. Now, in the old traditions, this was generally understood. Such a symbolic theme, for example, is the virgin birth, which occurs throughout the American Indian mythology. I mean, this is what wakened me to the realization that these things had not to do with historical events. The mythic image of the virgin birth refers to the birth of the spiritual life in the human animal. We can live with the same interests as animals, clinging to life, begetting future generations, and winning our place in the world. But then they can open the sense of a dimension of spiritual quest and realization. And then there is the birth, you might say, of the spiritual life. And this is the sense of the virgin birth.
Is mythology just a study of the past, or is it also a study of the present?
Well, insofar as the mythic forms are alive today, it's a study of the present. And this is the sense of the work of Freud and Jung, They found that in the psyche, in the individual dreams, there were mythic motifs, and that those represented the dynamics of the individual life. Somehow they symbolized what the person was really living for, whether his intellect knew it or not. And so we can say that myth lives today in our own spirits, in our own lives, whether we recognize it as such or not. And when one does begin to recognize it as such, then one can turn to the mythic tradition in which one has been brought up, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, Hinduism, or whatnot, and find effective support there for one's own quests and realizations.
Let's take a typical myth that most people would be familiar with, say the myth of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table and the search for the Holy Grail. How would that myth be relatable to present time?
The problem of the Grail Quest is the revivification, reanimation of what is known as the wasteland. The wasteland is a world where people live not out of their own initiative, but doing what they think they're supposed to do. And people have inherited their official roles and positions. They haven't earned them. And this is the situation of the wasteland. Everybody leading a false life. T.S. Eliot picked that up, you see, in his poem, The Wasteland, and he actually quotes several lines from Wolfram's Parsifal. And it's a place where the sense of the vitality of life has gone. People take jobs because they just, you gotta live, that sort of thing, and then they find in midlife that their job doesn't mean a thing. A friend of mine gave me a list of little sayings, how you know you're old, you know. He says, you've got to the top of the ladder and find it's against the wrong wall, that kind of thing. You see? Well, that's because you really weren't doing what your inside told you to do. Now, the hero of the Grail is the one who acts out of his own spontaneous nature. And he comes to the Grail Castle, and here is the Grail King, who is maimed and lame, as the whole country is. Why is he maimed and lame? Because he just inherited the job. Do you see? And I won't go through how it all happened, but the sense of it is that he was not living out of the spontaneity of his own life. The hero comes and lives out of the spontaneity of his own life, but unfortunately, when he was told how to be a knight, he was told, knights do not ask questions.